You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. I don't have to tell you that driving a car in LA can be frustrating. But there are other ways to get around, of course, like riding the bus or train. Well, these days, you can also add e-bikes to that list. In the last few years, sales of electric bikes have surged. And over the last 9 months, a growing number of e-bike lending programs have been popping up all across LA. Today, we're focusing on one in the San Fernando Valley.
It really is meant for community members to use whenever they want, whenever they need, and to really feel like a cyclist.
That's Melissa Walk. She helps manage ElectroBC. It's an e-bike lending library in Pacoima. Now, unlike other bike shares in LA where you pay by the hour, you can check out these bikes for months at a time for a $20 donation. KCRW's Andrea Bautista tells us how it works.
I'm on Van Nuys Boulevard riding a bright red e-bike in a bike lane with about 15 other people. But every time a car drives by, I find myself clenching the handlebars just a little bit tighter. The cars whooshing past me are nerve-wracking. After all, I haven't used a bike since I was in college. But the e-bike is making this ride surprisingly easy. The pedal assist helps me move faster. This is part of a program run by Pacoima Beautiful. It's a nonprofit organization that has been fighting for environmental justice in the area since 1996. ElectroBC program manager Melissa Walk says they secured funding through LADWP's Community Emission Reduction Grant.
So it's really promoting the decreased use of vehicles and the increased use of EVs, electric bicycles, public transportation, whatnot.
The LADWP grant was created to help reduce emissions in Harbor and Northeast San Fernando Valley communities, which have historically been hit by pollution from truck traffic and refineries. In 2020, for instance, LADWP revealed that a power plant it owned in neighboring Sun Valley was leaking methane for over a year. With the $500,000 grant, Pacoima Beautiful was able to open and staff a bike shop. The nonprofit also partnered with Shared Mobility, Inc. to get 120 e-bikes for free. They were formerly Uber Jump bikes, which people rented hourly. Riders can check out the bikes for up to 9 months. Before they hit the streets, riders have to take safety classes. All good so far, but bike riding in LA, and this program in particular, have two problems. First, Southern California culture, which prioritizes cars. Adonia Lugo is with the UCLA Institute of Transportation Studies. She studies transportation equity to increase options for underserved communities.
We have a really toxic road culture where we do not take good care of each other. When we're out there, you know, traveling in Los Angeles, and you see these like bigger and bigger cars where people can't even see the pedestrians who are in front of them, like there's a really toxic us versus them mentality that we bring to our streets.
LA has made efforts to improve bike infrastructure, but progress has slowed. Under Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, the city built up to 200 miles of bikeways a year. But that number has dropped dramatically. Last fiscal year, Streets Blog LA reports only about 26 miles were built, and 12 miles were upgraded. The second problem is specific to the bikes the Pacoima program uses. These bikes have about a 20-mile range. Then they need to be recharged. Melissa Walk says ElectroBC has 100 bikes, but only 28 chargers.
We do battery swapping at our bike shop because there's a lot of proprietary parts on them. So we have to use a special key to unlock the batteries. And then we use special chargers to charge the batteries.
Saad Ladani, a student at Woodbury University in Burbank, said he used the e-bike a lot in the summer because it made errands easier.
Things like getting groceries would be much easier because before I'd have to think about, oh, you know, like I'm riding my bike. So it's like a workout just to go and get groceries. So I think having an e-bike made it much easier for me to just get around and get to those places.
But having to get to Pacoima for the battery swap was tough.
But this semester had been quite hectic for me, and I was just on campus. So I didn't go around much. Plus, I found it kind of just the range on the bike to be a challenge, like how far you can go. Because coming from Burbank to Pacoima and then having to, you know, swap out the battery, that was kind of a hindrance. So over the semester, it really reduced. But before the semester started in the summer, I was using it quite a bit.
ElectroBC manager Melissa Walk says they are starting to look for money to buy different bikes that can be charged at home. And the program isn't slowing down. They currently have 9 riders, but they're hoping to sign up another 20 riders this month. By the end of the year, they hope to have 80 bikes out in the community. Other e-bike libraries have also popped up across LA in the last year. Bike LA, which received the same grant as Pacoima Beautiful, created an e-bike program for small businesses near the Port of Los Angeles. Through the program, participants can use the e-bike at no cost for 6 months. Bike LA's Deputy Director Kevin Shin says that after that period, folks have a chance to buy their bike and pay it off over time if they need it.
The bikes that we are working with retail for around $1,600 before tax. We made it possible after the 6 months for the participants to purchase the e-bike that they are using at a discounted rate of $800.
And in the San Gabriel Valley, GoSGV launched a fleet of single rider e-bikes and family cargo bikes. There's also talk of an e-bike library coming to South LA. And next year, in 2024, Angelenos will vote on Healthy Streets LA, a ballot measure to require better bike access whenever the city has road work to do. For KCRW, I'm Andrea Bautista.
Just ahead on GLA, the price of natural gas is too damn high. Why the spike? And what you can do to make it just a little better in your pocketbook. That's yours after this quick break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Your natural gas bill may have you thinking twice about turning up the heat or slow cooking that brisket. Reports all over California are that the numbers on those bills are eye-popping, double, maybe triple over the month before or over the same month last year. So what's going on? Natural gas futures prices are trading at year-and-a-half lows across the country. But here at home, SoCal Gas recently sent out a notice to customers saying, quote, January bills are likely to be shockingly high. After accusations that oil companies were ripping you off at the gas pump, what's to be said about this sudden rise in the price of natural gas? Severin Borenstein is a professor at UC Berkeley Business School and is director of the Haas Energy Institute. Professor, welcome to you.
Nice to be with you.
So the utility blames high wholesale prices for the price jump, but you know, we're seeing these other articles, CNN recently publishing one that says natural gas prices haven't been this low since Russia went to war in Ukraine. So what's going on here?
Well, natural gas prices are low in the eastern part of the country and pretty much everywhere outside the west and southwest. But the prices have really skyrocketed in the west and southwest. And when you see that sort of price deviation, it's because the transportation between one area and the other isn't sufficient. Obviously, if you have gas in the middle of the country right now and you have a way to get it to the West Coast, you can make a lot of money selling it on the West Coast. The problem we seem to be running into is transportation, that is the pipelines, bringing gas from the areas where they have plenty of gas these days to the Southwest and California, where we have a real shortage of gas and don't seem to be able to bring more in fast enough.
I mean, California has north of 10, maybe 15% of the country's population. Wouldn't you have a pipeline that would work well getting the gas out west?
We do have a pipeline that brings gas out west. It has never been large enough to actually fulfill the demand on the highest demand days of the year. We rely on having storage out here as well as more gas coming in on the pipeline to meet demand on those days. And one of the things that has changed is that we have a lot less storage in California than we did a few years ago. Part of that is, of course, the Aliso Canyon disaster in Southern California that led to a reduction in its capacity. At the same time, pipelines are owned by companies trying to make money. And so while it could just be a shortage of pipeline capacity, there's always the concern that the pipeline might be able to make money by actually squeezing the market a bit. But probably the starting point, the fundamental issue, is that we don't have as much storage and we don't have enough pipeline capacity to meet the demand. So we have seen prices in California that are holding at 4 times higher than they are in the middle of the country.
Is that getting fixed, do you think?
Well, I think there's always concern about this. There's a limited pipeline capacity. Building more pipeline capacity costs money, and there's always a concern that we'd be building too much and wasting money and raising rates that way. And at the same time, we have been losing natural gas storage facilities in the western area. And that makes it all the more tedious when we get to these tight markets. And then we hit a very cold snap with high gas demand, but also high electricity demand. And a lot of that natural gas goes into making electricity. And suddenly the system is very strained.
Yeah, I mean, some utilities use natural gas, right, to power some of their plants. So what's this current jump in the price of natural gas doing to the electricity market? Is that going to make those prices go up?
It is. And in fact, the wholesale price of electricity has gone way up. The only good news there for consumers is that generally their utilities that are buying power for them are buying a lot of it on long-term contract. So unlike our natural gas supply, they have some hedging that allows them to buffer the ups and downs of electricity prices. Utilities generally do very little or no hedging for consumers on natural gas prices for retail consumption. That's good news, of course. When the price of natural gas goes down, you get to enjoy the benefits of those low prices. But it's very bad news when we see a spike like this.
Do you see this breaking anytime soon? Is next month's bill going to be better?
I wouldn't guarantee it. I think that we have a structural problem here. And if we get a milder winter, and that may be starting to happen now, that will reduce demand for both natural gas and electricity, and that will probably allow it to come down. It actually has come down quite a bit from an enormous spike we saw a couple of weeks ago, but they're still way more expensive. And when that flows through, that raises our gas bills.
Severin Borenstein, UC Berkeley Business School professor and director of the Haas Energy Institute. Professor, thanks for coming on and talking about it.
Happy to be with you.
We appreciate it. All right, let's talk to John Healy now, senior editor for the LA Times Utility Journalism Team. Hey, John.
Hey there.
You've been writing a lot about this, haven't you?
Well, it's certainly the topic of the moment. I mean, getting a bill like folks are going to get in this month is quite a shock.
So, all right, let's talk about the utility, SoCalGas, which is offering programs to help folks deal with those rate hikes. Tell us a little bit about those and how you can qualify and take advantage of that. What do you do?
There are a couple of different approaches that people can take. There's one that's available to anybody, and that is called the level pay plan. What the level pay plan does is it takes your average monthly use over the course of a year and then has your bill spread out so that your low summer usage months help you in the winter and your high usage months in the winter hurt you in the summer. You spend the same amount over the course of the year, you're going to end up paying for all the gas you use. But month by month, it's going to feel a lot better in the winter and a bit worse in the summer. That's a pretty standard thing, as well as offers to, if you're behind on your bill or if you can't pay this month's bill, to give you more time to pay that one big bill.
There are other programs outside of SoCalGas, right? Tell us about those programs.
California has a California Alternate Rates for Energy program. And in that, you can get a 20% discount if your household is qualified in terms of your income. Now, that means you have to earn some fraction of the median income. For a family of three, for example, it's about $46,000 a year. And when you apply for that, it's generally you're just asserting to them. You don't have to fill a bunch of paperwork. You're just telling them, look, I am, for example, I receive CalFresh food stamps, or I'm on Medi-Cal. And that should enable you to qualify for these discounted rates.
So at least that's 20% off, right? That's not nothing.
That's not nothing. Then there's the federal low-income home energy assistance program, LIHEAP. Now, LIHEAP is a one-time payment, so it's not going to help you month after month after month. But there's two different versions of LIHEAP that could really be helpful. One, it's between $250 and $750, roughly, in aid depending on the cost of gas in your area. Now, this is, again, only for people who qualify in terms of their income. And it's between, I think it's about 60% of the local median income. So, again, you're talking about $45,000 or so for a family of three over the course of a year. Now, with that, that is if you're having your gas service hasn't been disconnected. You're paying month after month, but you have a big bill that you need some help with. If you are at risk of being disconnected because you have a bunch of bills that you haven't paid or your service has been disconnected, you can get up to $3,000 worth of help from LIHEAP. Now, the tricky thing about LIHEAP is there's no one place to go to apply for it. It's provided through community groups, and those groups vary from neighborhood to neighborhood. The state of California has a site that'll help you find the local groups that offer it. So if you go to the California Department of Community Services and Development and look up LIHEAP there, L-I-H-E-A-P, you will find a link there that will show you, here are the places in your neighborhood, in your community, that can help you get these funds.
L-I-H-E-A-P, LIHEAP. We'll have a link to that, by the way, at our website. So that's for you. There are things that that you also can do, right, to reduce the amount of gas. I mean, turn the thermostat down, right, in the wintertime. If you have natural gas heat, things like that. Don't use the stove so much.
And there are also rebates and other incentives that the gas companies offer to help you buy appliances that use less energy and do weatherization to reduce the amount of heat that you have to use to keep your home livable. So those things, there are marketplaces on the Southern California Gas site and the Los Angeles DWP site where you can look for those rebates to get things that may actually cut your gas bill because you're using less gas to do the same things.
John Healy, who's part of the utility team for the LA Times. John, thanks for your work. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Last November's elections brought slim conservative majorities to the Orange and Capistrano school boards. And in the last few weeks, there's been change at those systems in the county of Orange. Over the winter break, those newly elected conservative majorities ousted a couple of superintendents and put one assistant superintendent on administrative leave with little notice. Here to talk about those shakeups in Orange County is Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, and of course, a regular here on GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Walk us through what happened with those two school boards. How have they changed? What happened?
Well, it's actually something that was attempted throughout the country, really, where you had these conservative groups telling folks you should run for school board because the future of our children are at stake with this radical agenda about ethnic studies and LGBT indoctrination. And so while the overall narrative across the United States for the midterm elections was that the Republican red wave was really just a trickle, it was a little bit different with school boards. You did have, and so this is what happened at both Orange Unified and Capistrano Unified School Districts, which Orange covers mostly the city of Orange and then parts of unincorporated Orange County. Capistrano Unified covers a huge chunk of South Orange County. So you had these conservative majorities win, and these were people who were running on this platform of we need to take back the schools from them, whoever them are.
Well, I mean, and let's be clear, when we say indoctrination, right? I mean, that is, those, it's coded language, right?
Yeah, I'm not saying it's indoctrination. They're the ones who are using this language. They're the ones who call something as simple as learning about the role of minorities in California history critical race theory, even though critical race theory is just academic jargon for the colleges. And this is something that's been playing out at school districts over the past couple of years. On top of that, of course, we know the pandemic. And so in these two school districts, you had trustees who ran, or now trustees who ran on that. And now that they're in power, remember, the election was only, like 6-7 weeks ago, not that long ago, and they're already making their presence felt.
So these firings happened very fast, right, with very little public notice. How did they go about doing it? Without cause? Is there a lawsuit involved here? Do they have to pay severance? How does that work?
Well, what happened was that they announced it. You have to announce it publicly. We're going to have a board meeting about this particular subject. So with Capistrano Unified, I wasn't really paying too much attention to it, but I know in Orange Unified, literally with less than 24-hour notice, they said, we're going to have this the following day. So I remember on Twitter, I posted like, wait, didn't this also happen in Capo Unified? By then, you already had a lot of parents angry and upset. And yes, you can legally do that. Like most boards, I mean, you're going to have contracts. So if there's going to be severance pay, it all depends on the contract of the superintendents who are being let go. But boards, they have that power to be able to hire and fire superintendents according to their discretion.
In the city of Orange, the school board president, Rick Ledesma, said the reason for the ouster of their superintendent was, quotes, I'm quoting him here, "We think we have drifted away from academics and educating students. We have been focusing too much on the social politics of education." What does that mean?
It's dog whistles. Ledesma's longtime activist in Orange. And so he's just upset that, at least according to him and others, like, school teachers are spending way too much time teaching their students about ethnic studies, about LGBTQ inclusivity, about what being kind and respectable, and apparently not teaching enough about reading, writing, and arithmetic. I mean, this is something, especially in Orange County, you've been hearing this sort of conspiracies for decades, going back to the 50s and 60s. And so Orange County has historically been this place where you have these battles. In the 60s, it was about sex education. In the early 2000s, a very Orange Unified School District, they had a big issue with a student who wanted to start an LGBTQ club, one of the first in the United States at the high school level at El Medina High. So there is nothing new under the sun when it comes to Orange County conservative politics.
So they've gotten the superintendents out. Who are they going to replace them with? People who believe the same way that they do, right? And I assume there's a large pool of folks who would be eager to go into those jobs.
Yeah, one of the trustees in Orange, she posted on Facebook how she was asking that specific question. Who are these candidates that we are thinking of hiring to replace superintendents who, by the way, had very few complaints, both the ones in Orange, Gunmary Hansen, and down in Capo Unified, Kristen Vital Brult, they didn't not have many complaints, at least from most parents, you know? And so she, you know, in Orange Unified, the trustee was told, oh, yeah, you could Google the person. And like, that's how these boards are going to consider whether to hire someone, by Googling their resume. What's next? Trying to find their LinkedIn or Wikipedia page?
Are parents concerned about these new school boards? Is there any kind of, when it comes to, you know, like a reaction, is there calls for removal?
Oh, yeah. The parents at Orange Unified, they're already getting paperwork ready for a recall. And Capo Unified for decades was a place where there was recall after recall after recall. So this is just politics as usual at school boards in Orange County, coming to a school board near you.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist of the LA Times, and of course every week here with the OC Line. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, the local government took away their valuable beachfront land, but nearly a century later, the Bruce family got it back. Well, now they're selling it back to L.A. County for millions of dollars. An update on that story and the work of California's Reparations Task Force 2 tomorrow, right here on Greater L.A. What's on your mind? Have a story idea for us? Let us know at our website, kcrw.com/GLA, one of the few places in California that's dry at the moment. Subscribe to the podcast, too, by the way, kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zeke Reed, telling you guys, Ted Robbins, John Meek, Phil Richards, Amy Todd, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Camito, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the episode together. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the ear. Have a great night.